very helpful. Because you start thinking and looking for definitions. And
okay, I'm going to call to order this meeting of the Senate Committee on the Environment and Natural Resources. It is Monday, May 1st, 2017.
I'm calling to order the House Committee on Energy and Environment.
Okay. Well, we have a very interesting presentation today. The result of many discussions and a lot of work by a group of individuals from the business community who are interested in what Oregon can do with respect to the challenges of climate change. And so we are going to be hearing about the report called Business Smart Strategies for Decarbonizing Oregon's Economy. And we're going to hear from the people who are involved in the production of that. So is it Merritt first?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. So through the wonders of technology, we have Merritt Paulson there on the screen. We actually have two of you here with us, Merritt. Thank you very much for your work on this project. And if you could just introduce yourself for the record and kick us off, that would be great.
Sure. And I apologize for not being there in person today. Hopefully the technology works out okay, and I'm thrilled that Kathy and Lane and John are at least able to be there in my absence. But at the outset, I'd love to thank both chairs, Helm and Dembrow, and the rest of the members of the committee for allowing us to present today. As you indicated, the Oregon Business Leaders Greenhouse Gas Reduction Task Force is a culmination of a ton of work. We can meet the group of members of private sector across a wide variety of industries. Many of those industries are high carbon output industries. Over the course of a year, we met at times for 3-hour sessions plus every month, and had experts in this space present to us, and really did a very, very deep dive. Now, the group was brought together and convened by the Nature Conservancy. There was a mandate from the global chapter that every state chapter take a look at what we could do locally to address climate change. So Kathy and the rest of the leadership at TNC Oregon sort of took a convening role in bringing us together. And I was asked, along with John Carter, to co-chair the initiative. Now, to say that John and I come from different ideologies on climate change would probably be a little bit of an understatement. To me, it's one of the biggest issues that we face, not only nationally, but globally. John, on the other hand, comes from an industry that's extremely impacted by environmental regulations and energy prices, and brought a unique perspective as well. I would say that to say that I'm extremely proud of what we produced over the course of these 12 months would be an understatement. What you've got before you is a very detailed report that we have unanimous support from every member of the task force on. And, it's something that's a powerful statement from the private sector about what a material issue this is. And we believe this. So, rather than just rambling on the screen, I'll hand it over to Lane, who is also on this task force, and maybe can give you some insight from his perspective. And then we'll turn it over to Kathy.
Okay, Lane, you want to come up? Actually, all three of you can come up if you'd like. So we have Lane, John, and Kathy, all three up
before
us. So, Lane, I guess you have the baton.
It sounds like it.
Chair Dembrough, Chair Helm, very nice to be with you today for the record. My name is Lane Shutterly, appearing here today as a member of the Greenhouse Gas, Oregon Business Leaders Greenhouse Gas Reduction Task Force. As Merritt told you, this was a diverse group. And frankly, at the first couple of meetings, I wondered what on earth we were going to accomplish with all the different viewpoints in the room. But we were ably led by our co-chairs and staffed by a terrific group of experts, two of whom are with me today, and I'm going to be brief because I want you to hear most of the report from them today. And over the course of the year, I really do commend the group for having stayed on task and focused on the assignment that we were given through with the Nature Conservancy, and that is to address greenhouse gas emissions from not only an environmental but also a business and economic standpoint. We did that. And the report that you have today, as Merritt said, is a consensus product of the members of this diverse group. I think I was on this group because I represented the critical country lawyer sector of the Oregon economy, and also maybe just because I had a little legislative background and history that they thought might be useful in their deliberations. And I was, for whatever reason, I was pleased to be involved. And if you look in the second page of the report, in the preface, it lists the task force members, and you can see it's a real A team of Oregon business leaders and some of our leading major businesses in the state. Just a few things I think I want to say in terms of takeaways on this report to tee up the presentations we'll be getting from John Taponia and Kathy McDonald. One is that in this report, as you look through it, it is grounded in solid science and economics. The recommendations and information that you have there is ground tested. And I commend it to you without reservation. Second point that I would make about the report is it does make the point that Oregon has done a very good job in reducing its carbon footprint. In fact, in many ways, we're already ahead of the game in terms of other states across the country. We are not the leader, and by the same token, even though we have made great strides, we did recognize in the task force that Oregon still needs to do more in order to reach its goals. So we have something to commend ourselves, but we can't rest on our laurels. There is more to do to achieve our goals in greenhouse gas reduction. The third point that I would make is that there is a business case to be made for greenhouse gas reduction. These were business leaders who were looking at greenhouse gas reduction from that perspective and recognizing that there is opportunity to be had in moving forward in greenhouse gas reduction in a responsible and proactive manner. And fourth, what I would say is that I hope you will use the task force members, again, their names are there, as partners and resources for any work that you do going forward in greenhouse gas reduction legislation and policy making. These are folks who have been through a year of intense training on the subject of greenhouse gas reduction. We've had the conversations about greenhouse gas reduction in the economy and how it can benefit Oregon's economy when it's done properly. And I hope that you will take advantage of this group of newly minted experts in the field of business and greenhouse gas reduction. So with that, Chair Dembrough, Chair Helm, I'll turn it over to whoever's next, and I'll be happy to join for any questions, perhaps when they get done with their comments. But thank you very much.
Thank you, Lane.
Chairs Dembrough and Helm, thank you very much, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Catherine McDonald. I'm the Director of Policy and External Affairs for the Nature Conservancy. And as Lane just mentioned, we had a stellar cast of business leaders from a variety of business sectors and across the state. We had great advice and counsel, in addition from the Association of Associated Oregon Industries, Oregon Business Council, and Oregon Business Association. Staff from those organizations helped us identify the business leaders that we included, and then also participated, or at least attended the task force meetings and provided advice and counsel along the way.
The slides aren't showing on the screen.
Excuse me. Do you?
There we go.
Great. Thank you.
Well, Merritt's still on, but he can see us. We can't see him. Right? Are you still there, Merritt?
I don't know.
I don't think he can hear.
Okay.
I think you can't hear him when we have this on.
Right.
So here are the folks that were on the task force, and you have the copies of the report in front of you. Merritt touched on why the Nature Conservancy supported this task force effort. As Merritt mentioned, our board of directors globally asked us to do what we thought was the next best thing we could do within our state authority to reduce greenhouse gas emissions. And their reason for that, of course, is that climate change is really going to have the biggest impact on our ability to meet our mission and has huge effects on people and nature. For those of you that are not as familiar with the Nature Conservancy, we operate in over 69 countries across the world and in every state within here in the United States. We were incorporated in Oregon in 1961 and largely started our work as a land protection and stewardship organization, and we've since expanded that to a much broader array of strategies. We work across the state with other stakeholders to try and find practical solutions that are science-based to challenges that are facing people and nature. And in doing so, this type of work lines up with that. The Nature Conservancy has over 50,000 supporters across the state. We have members in every county, and we have staff that operate as from Enterprise to Klamath Falls to the Dalles. And Burns, Oregon, so all across the state. And in doing that, it allows us to really work with a wide range of Oregonians to try and find collective solutions and collaborative solutions to problems. We started off the task force really by just taking stock of the challenge associated with climate change and the major contributing factor, which are emissions. And as you can see here on this graph, the red shows the business as usual emissions and the relationship between emissions and concentrations in the atmosphere that are really what drives climate change. The projections are that in order for us to really keep climate change below levels that really would cause huge disruptions to our society, we really need to reduce emissions and stay under 450 parts per million in terms of concentrations. And we need to do that, start reducing dramatically soon and bring it as close to zero as we can by around in the next few decades. As Lane and Merritt mentioned, we were fortunate to have a great group of experts that helped us inform the discussions. We met over the course of a year, as Merritt mentioned. Our goal was to try and design a five-year action plan that not only reduced greenhouse gas emissions, but really identified ways that we could do that that also maintained a strong economy. It's going to be expensive to adapt to climate change, and it's going to be expensive to reduce greenhouse gas emissions. The only way we can do that responsibly is by doing it with methods that keep a strong economy. So it's, that part was really important. And that's a big part of why the Nature Conservancy felt that it was critical for us to start our work by learning as much as we could about how different strategies interact with the greenhouse gas with the economy. Excuse me. We started with a kind of a primer on Oregon's greenhouse gas emissions. We talked about the characteristics of emission reduction policies and how they can be designed to reduce impacts to the economy. And then we talked about energy efficiency strategies, the role of research and development, agriculture and forestry types of strategies, transportation, carbon pricing, finance mechanisms, and state administration of climate mitigation. So with that, I will turn it over to John, and he will give you a little bit of the rundown of what we learned along the way.
All right. Chair Dembro, Chair Helm, for the record, I'm John Tapponia, President of Echo Northwest, and delighted to collaborate on this piece of work. As you can see, I'm going to start with just our low-carbon credentials. I am frequently invited to Salem and other places to talk about other aspects of public policy that are a bit more challenging to us. But this is one where Oregon is a bright spot in the country. Oregon's total carbon dioxide ranks 38. That's on the good end of that list. Oregon's energy consumption per capita, also 38th. Greenhouse gas emissions declined in nominal terms 8% between 2005 and 2015, and per capita emissions were down 21%. So the population was growing as greenhouse gas emissions were declining. There are reasons for that. Obviously, we do have a relatively mild climate in this corner of the country. We have ample hydroelectric power. We passed policies through time to reduce emissions and have invested in energy efficiency. So we have been active and also sort of taken advantage of our natural place in the continent. In terms of the business case for emission reduction, Kathy alluded to some of it, but in the first and foremost, by reducing energy needs and waste, businesses can improve their bottom line. In many cases, this is obviously going on. Businesses are always looking for ways to improve productivity and reduce costs, and so this, in many respects, is a natural space to be working in for the business community. There are substantial and diverse risks facing the United States economy and its assets, and Merritt's father has taken a leadership position in making that case known nationally, and so this group certainly recognizes that and embraces it. Businesses that reduce their greenhouse gas footprint and produce products to reduce the emissions will have a significant market advantage. So to the extent that businesses in Oregon are getting ahead of this issue, are anticipating a future where businesses in other states and other parts of the country, of the world, are going to be having to do this, we will have a head start. And jurisdictions with low-carbon, low-cost energy and supportive policies for reducing greenhouse gas emissions will be well-positioned for business expansion and to attract new businesses. So this is essentially, you know, sort of in the Wayne Gretzky skate to where the puck is going to be. We're skating to where the puck is going to be in this one, and anticipating a change that is well-documented, well-anticipated by science. Over the course of the year, this became one of my favorite charts with respect to the sort of the trends over time. And so this is what I would call the decoupling chart. Oregon has, in many respects, successfully decoupled greenhouse gas emissions from economic output. So what we have here are a variety of economic indicators. The one on the top is our real gross domestic product. The next one is the real gross domestic product if we take the computer manufacturing sector out of the economy. So you can see just how much that particular industry is hitting the top-line GDP numbers. Then next is population, which was on the rise. This is an index, so all of these are trends relative to 1997. Then non-farm employment, and then finally greenhouse gas emissions. So as we sort of opened this presentation, or I opened my part of the presentation saying that greenhouse gas emissions had dropped by 8% and per capita terms dropped by 21%, that's what this chart is saying. The core issue is wonderful. That's wonderful news, but it needs to do more. Here are the greenhouse gas goals relative to the projected baseline developed by the Oregon Global Warming Commission. And so despite wonderful progress, we still have an awful long way to go. So challenges to meeting those greenhouse gas goals, as described by the task force. Those state goals are not binding. The Global Warming Commission is under-resourced. State agencies aren't mandated to implement measures to reduce greenhouse gas emissions. Federal state investments in reducing greenhouse gas emissions have declined. Existing state policy investment playing field is complex, and without careful design, greenhouse gas emissions can have a significant impact on the Oregon economy. And I will say that one again. Without significant design, you can have significant impacts on the Oregon economy. So I think certainly a consensus among this task force that action needs to be taken, and the business community needs to get out ahead of this. But we do have to remember that all the moves are there are winners and losers going forward, and industries that can be adversely affected if care isn't taken in the policy design.
With respect to emissions by sector, this should be a familiar one. The point here that stood out to the task force is that if you look at the combination of transportation, residents, and commercial, which would be the sort of the bottom two areas of that line chart, the large majority of greenhouse gases are being produced by people in their offices, in their homes, and in their vehicles. And so if offices, homes, and vehicles aren't addressed by this, you're not going to get anywhere close to your goals. And obviously there is a role for industry, but it is sort of a smaller one than if you had gone back 25 years ago or so. So now let's go into some of these topics. First, on transportation and Oregon's economy. This is one where I would characterize as being more consensus on the task force in terms of the recommendations and the sense of the problem. Clearly, as this task force was convening every monthly meeting, the roads were getting more and more congested in the Portland metropolitan area, and some people were coming later and later to the meetings because of the congestion. And so if one were to talk about a nice overlap of where you could do good for the economy and address greenhouse gases at the same time, the task force definitely saw big opportunities in transportation. Looking back at a circa 2015 Portland Business Alliance report, transportation has a huge impact on the Oregon economy, more than $300 billion in goods moved in a variety of modes of transportation. 20% of all jobs in Oregon in some way are either directly transportation or dependent on transportation. And congestion is expensive and getting worse. And I think everybody here knows that. So the first sort of strategic point, address congestion in the Portland metropolitan area to get freight and people moving. That first recommendation was design a congestion pricing and improved transit program for the Portland metropolitan area. I will say that with respect to congestion, that congestion pricing is the answer at the back of the textbook. The state or the region is not going to build its way out of congestion. It simply will never happen. What probably stands between us and the answer at the back of the textbook is politics and political opinion about congestion pricing. But I will tell you, whether it be 10, 20, 30, 40, or 70 years from now, the answer to congestion is to price it, not to build your way out of it. And the task force was very, very focused on this for at least a couple of sessions. They would prefer a bold step into this space, are less interested in pilot or demonstration projects, and would like to see leadership by the state and the region on this particular topic. While doing so, also strategically investing in intelligent transportation systems, and obviously in understanding that there are some key physical bottlenecks in the Portland metropolitan area in its roadways that should be addressed. So that was one big plank. In addition, on the transportation side, doing what we can to accelerate conversion to alternative fuel vehicles. Clearly, that doesn't happen very quickly unless there is some kind of investment in alternative vehicle infrastructure. We built up an infrastructure around gasoline over the course of the early and middle part of the last century, and alternative vehicles aren't going to disseminate until we address this infrastructure intentionally for alternative fuels. Develop a blueprint for deploying renewable natural gas and design and implement alternative fuel vehicle incentives to achieve the maximum greenhouse gas benefits. So those were sort of the key recommendations in the transportation section. And again, in this report, all kinds of full paragraphs and description and footnotes for anyone who wants to learn more about that. Moving on to energy efficiency, the strategic plank is regain Oregon's leadership in energy efficiency. With this, this graph is a sort of representation of Washington, California's and Oregon's building codes in terms of their energy saving potential. And Oregon, Oregon was sort of in the pack, but it, with the forecast going forward, it's going to fall behind Washington and California in terms of the energy saving capability of its building codes. So work to be done there. Echo Northwest has engaged with the Northwest Energy Efficiency Alliance to run economic impact studies on this. We are persuaded that more investment in energy efficiency can create jobs. This chart simply plays out job and output impacts associated with the actual delivery or construction of energy efficiency projects. Energy efficiency projects are very local labor intensive, and so investing in energy efficiency captures more money in your local economy than generic other investments that are not energy efficiency projects. And the other piece that is valuable about energy efficiency is that it saves spending on utilities, and so sort of after you've gone through the effort of building a more efficient home or a more efficient office or a more efficient factory, you reduce your spending on utilities, which then can be spent in other sectors, and that too generates jobs. We have a whole separate report on that that we could share with anybody who has interest in that one. That brings us to the fourth recommendation. And that is invest in the development of a thorough analysis and modeling effort to inform development of any carbon pricing program. So this one, as Merritt alluded, there was a diversity of opinions and industries and perspectives on the task force. And clearly you have, you not only have utilities, but you have high carbon input industries on there as well. They fully understand the direct impacts that either a cap and trade system or a carbon tax program would have on their operations, and would embrace investigation of these approaches. But clearly, this is one of those areas where you want to move into this space carefully, understanding that you don't want to abruptly disrupt and harm individual industries or regions of the state. You know, from the economist's perspective, again, certainly economists would lean toward, and there's this little poll on the right-hand side of the top 40 economists in the United States, a poll of the University of Chicago. It's economists from Stanford and Yale and Harvard and Chicago and elsewhere, ideologically diverse set of folks. Strongly agree or agree that if there is a commitment to greenhouse gas emissions, that the most efficient way to get there would be to, in some shape or form, send a market signal and create a price to incent actors throughout the economy to move on the topic.
And as John indicated, this was certainly a topic that we talked about a lot, in large part because anytime you're applying an economy-wide strategy like carbon pricing, obviously it's very complicated and has different impacts to different business sectors. And as a result, we spent quite a bit of time, or the task force spent quite a bit of time talking about this topic. There was kind of a different opinions about how to best go forward, with some of the folks really feeling like we should come out with a recommendation of strongly endorsing a carbon pricing program, but also others on the task force that felt just as strongly that you really couldn't responsibly endorse something that hadn't been designed and hadn't been analyzed yet. So where we landed was that the task force really felt like there was some additional follow-on research that should be done in order to best design any kind of a carbon pricing program that might come down the road for Oregon. There was some great work done or going on as the task force was meeting that you all directed Oregon Department of Environmental Quality to do, and that's a great, great foundation. There's been some additional work that's been done since by the Association of Oregon Industries. Those are great foundational pieces, but some additional work but could really contribute to helping to look at, in particular, ways of mitigating business leakage, companies moving elsewhere where carbon prices might be lower, energy costs might be lower, and that's something that obviously we don't want to see happen, because that would have an impact on Oregon's economy. The fifth area relates to Oregon's agricultural and forest business sectors. As you'll recall from the wedge analysis, not the wedge analysis, but the graph of where emissions come from, that's a relatively smaller part of Oregon's emissions. But because it's such an important part of our rural economy, the task force really wanted to make sure while we were looking at this that we identified some strategies and measures that could be taken to benefit these sectors. It's also one of the most complicated of the sectors to think about because it both has emissions and opportunities for sequestration. And so as we talked about this, we also talked about some of the just complexities of evaluating the right approaches and advancing strategies. Right now, Oregon doesn't have a comprehensive land-based carbon accounting. If we're going to allow land to be part of the solution for carbon climate mitigation, it's important that we have that kind of a comprehensive inventory. Globally, there's been some research that suggests that 37% of the global greenhouse gas emission reduction that's needed by 2035, could be made up from land-based investments, either in agriculture, changes in management in forestry, and ecosystem restoration. So there's some great opportunity there. In addition to land-based carbon accounting, Oregon also could greatly benefit from being able to find additional uses for converting biomass into energy. And the science is currently out on some of that, and that's limiting our ability to take advantage of that and look for ways to address our increased fuel loads in our forests. And so investing in trying to help answer that question about how forest restoration, especially in fire-prone forests, and use of biomass might reduce or provide opportunities to reduce emissions is another step that the task force felt that Oregon was well positioned to help advance. The last two were focused on helping businesses continue to reduce emissions associated with through biomass utilization, and then looking for opportunities where you could gain irrigation efficiencies and generate power, reduce power use, generate power, and also potentially put water back in stream where that's appropriate as another great approach to reducing emissions that would also benefit other Oregon priority outcomes. The last two strategies that we'll just touch on, the first, we looked at the way Oregon finances greenhouse gas emission reductions and some of those programs and found that there are some opportunities for tweaking those programs to some degree to allow them to operate a little more smoothly. The energy incentive programs in particular, and you can find some more specific recommendations on page 21 of the report. And then second, the small-scale energy loan program, providing some additional financial tools tools to that program would allow it to take better advantage of private investments. And there are a number of states that have advanced so-called green banks, which the small-scale energy loan program is a green bank, but would just allow it to have a little, some additional tools that would help it better leverage capital. And then finally, we looked back, going back to some of the challenges that John identified early on in his talk, we looked at how the agencies or how the state's currently structured to reduce greenhouse gas emissions. And I'm sure it's no surprise to all of you, there are multiple agencies that have responsibilities. Individual agencies aren't really mandated to reduce emissions. So we saw a number of opportunities for improving the administration of Oregon's greenhouse gas emission reduction efforts, and also some need for additional resources so that the state can be more proactive, provide more guidance and analysis to guide really smart approaches to reducing emissions and to allow us to kind of get on a longer path designed and supported by critical information. Now, obviously, in a year with as much time as we did put into the process, we weren't able to get to detailed recommendations on exactly how you would design policies and programs. But we did look at a number of kind of design approaches and things that are important to consider. There's some just good information that's available on how you think about how to design these policies that works best for business, and the report includes some information on how to go about doing that, how to go about marrying different policies so they leverage one another, and the report talks about that as well. And then finally, just from the perspective of setting priorities and how we think about how to best do this work in Oregon, certainly the task force wanted to emphasize the need to look for ways of designing policies to prevent business leakage, to avoid and mitigate disproportionate impacts to rural Oregon and to low-income Oregonians, and then always to look for ways that we can build on our existing strengths and, when possible, align policies and programs to meet multiple state goals. And then finally, just in conclusion, I think the task force members and certainly staff at the Nature Conservancy came away with that whole effort with the realization that it is possible to continue to grow goods and services in Oregon while reducing greenhouse gas emissions. Our business leaders here in the state have demonstrated that and have been very effective at finding ways to reduce emissions. Your support as legislators is really important. Policies and incentive programs can really help along the way to develop new technologies and get them out in the marketplace. And then finally, there is a need to kind of strengthen how Oregon approaches both financing and administering greenhouse gas emission reduction. So with that, thank you. Open it to questions.
Okay, thank you very much, all three of you.
We can get Merritt back on.
Okay, let's start off with questions. Yes, Representative Brucksmith.
Thank you. Can we go back? Oh, well, actually, I was wanting to pull up a slide there on page 10. It was the slide that had, of course, our graph of the GDP and population growth and greenhouse emissions.
Coupling.
Yep. Right there. So when looking at the overall picture, right, we have population growth on a steady growth, we have GDP growth, and we have declining of emissions, right? Isn't that
the absolutely.
And so I guess my question is, where do you want that CHG line to be?
The GHG?
Excuse me, yes, the GHG line to be. Considering,
Why? Well, here it is.
There you have it.
Now, when you're, if you go back to the original slide, because I look at this and I see Oregon's doing a great job at policing greenhouse gas emissions, especially considering the population growth and mm-hmm. the GDP growth. And mind you, those reductions occurred before clean fuels and
right.
and before these goals that, what are they going to cost the citizens of Oregon, I guess is my real question. If you go to this next slide that you did, what's that cost the citizens of this state?
Well, the trick here is to figure out to make it cost the least possible as you achieve that goal, and that's the whole trick is there are thousands of different ways that you could attempt to achieve that blue line, the whole point of this report is to sit down and think about how to do it most cost effectively, most efficiently. We do have, as you pointed out, a host of different approaches. We have regulations that are in place on fuels and energy sources and such. We have bills and conversations about prices, et cetera. And I think what the whole purpose of this task force was to come together and say, boy, that looks like a pretty intimidating goal. How do we sit down collectively and think about how we try to get on that blue line without driving every business and household out of the state of Oregon, much to the contrary, actually, trying to grow the economy and grow population while we get on that green line.
Follow up.
Pardon, blue line, excuse me.
Yes, follow up.
Thank you. Well, I thank you for that, because I need to go back to my district and go to the first slide
yep.
and be able to tell the citizens, We've increased population, we've increased GDP growth, we're growing our economy, all the while before these goals were implemented.
Yep.
We're reducing carbon greenhouse gas emissions in the state, but now we have goals that are emitted that require, even though they're already on a decline with the increases in GDP and population, there's even more drastic goals that have to be met. How do I tell the citizens, my citizens in my district in rural Southwest Oregon, that they're going to have to pay more for energy, more for fuel, more for the cost of goods and services that are supplied through transportation chains, when they look at the first graph and say, but Representative Smith, we're already in a reduction. How are we supposed to, I don't understand.
Right.
I think in addition to making sure that we're designing smart policies as we go, it's also important to recognize that if we don't reduce emissions, we're going to have expenses associated with that. On the coast, ocean acidification, increased storm activity, those are going to cost your constituents as well.
Ma'am, the amount of carbon emissions that Oregon produces is less than 1% on the global scale.
I agree.
So, The lead by example doesn't work for me. I'm sorry.
Okay.
I would rather invest in innovations through our college and university sector to sell those innovations to larger carbon emitters so that we can reduce them.
Well, that's a great argument for getting more involved in
we
this.
We have a bill for that. Mm-hmm. Representative Bentz has that, actually.
I would agree that you. That's the reason we put the first chart in the piece is that perhaps not with quite as much intention and overall strategic framework, we've made a tremendous amount of progress. I mean, I come here and report on all kinds of things that I'm very sad to report about in the education or the pension system or what have you. This I looked at and I thought, finally, I can come and present some good news because Oregon has made some wonderful progress in this regard. And I think the point of this task force is to sit down and say, with a diversity of experience on that task force, there is no intention to sort of take the GDP and the population lines and crank them down to bend to the will to create the blue line. It is very much the to the contrary, which is how do we continue that kind of progress, but and hopefully accelerate that GHG line some.
And I might jump in because Representative Brock-Smith's comments make me think of a couple of things. One is we do have to recognize that a lot of those early gains were sort of low-hanging fruit.
That's a good point.
Right?
Mm-hmm.
And as as your goals go on, the harder and harder it's going to be, and the more deliberative the action's going to have to be. But having said that, the market will also be adapting. Technology will be adapting over the years, which in some ways will make things easier. So you have these sort of competing forces. Things are getting harder and harder in some ways, and perhaps easier and easier in other ways.
That's a good point.
Senator Linthicum.
A follow-on, if I may. If we could go back to that graph that shows Oregon is not projected to meet its GHG goals. There's a slight dogleg there at 2020 and then the blue line drawn out to 2050 at the legislative 10% below 1990 levels and the legislated 75% below 1990 levels. Those numbers are really numbers out of a hat, and therefore they represent somewhat of a false goal because there's no science behind 10% or 75%. These are numbers that have just been put on this graph, and we could have picked any other numbers. Let me offer that if we'd have picked 85% by 2050, the blue line would be even steeper, and we'd be the dog chasing its tail in a never-ending cycle to get to those numbers that are artificial. The 1990 number and the 10% below and 75% below are somewhat arbitrary, and I'm going to use the phrase somewhat with with quotation marks around it so that you realize I'm claiming that somewhat. Can you give sound scientific evidence for what the 10% and 75% numbers actually look like?
Captain. Chair Dembo, Chair Helm, members of the committee, Senator Linthicum. Those numbers actually did come from work that had been done by climate experts, people who understand the impact of emissions and concentrations, and then what the models predict will happen to our climate as a result. So those numbers are pretty close to and maybe even a little conservative relative to what scientists are telling us now about the need for emission reduction. So there is some information in the report about the origin of the fact, some references about where you can look to see how the goals that were established by the state of Oregon relate to what science is telling us.
Rep. Marsh.
I wanted to go to strategy 4, which was the carbon pricing program, and you noted that there needs to be more analysis and modeling. I don't know that any of us would disagree with that, but I wonder if you had any specific recommendations as to how to forward or take on that work.
Thank you, Chairs Dembro and Helm, Representative Marsh. The areas that we're looking at, and we've been doing some follow-on work specifically on this, is really to look at that businesses that are at risk, the energy-intensive, trade-exposed businesses in Oregon in particular, and to look at how you might pull together enough information to help design some of the policies that would reduce the impacts to those businesses. There are a number of mechanisms, and there's some information in the report about some of the kinds of mechanisms that can be applied to protect businesses that are in that situation. So the follow-on work that we're interested in seeing happen would be a combination of doing kind of the next step on what the Department of Environmental Quality and Associated Oregon Industries did to model Oregon's economy. AOI used more sophisticated models, which were really important to use, that I think DEQ didn't have the resources to use, but they did not link to the California or the Western Climate Initiative, and I think we can get some better information if we really look at how we would fit into that program. So that, looking at the business leakage and trying to look specifically at how you would design mechanisms to minimize business leakage, and then looking at the potential economic benefits from reinvestment of funds to both protect rural Oregon in particular and the kinds of economic benefits we might see in rural Oregon, and to communities that are near some of the businesses that produce a lot of the emissions, how you could reinvest in those communities to minimize impacts to low-income communities around those and all communities around in terms of their health. So those are the areas that I think we see some opportunity for some additional modeling that would help design the program.
Chair Helm.
No. Marsh had a follow-up.
You had a follow-up?
I'm sorry.
Sorry.
If I may.
Yeah.
Thank you, Chair. So to be quite blunt, are you saying you will take those on, or you think they need to be done, or do you have a plan?
We are currently working on a scope of work to try and take some of that on. We are trying to do that in collaboration with others that can help inform us, including the state of Oregon, and would love to share that workload.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you.
Representative Barnard, you're up.
Thank you. This is really a reaction, I think, in a sense, to Representative Rock Smith's question. As I look at these issues, one of the things that occurs to me is that when you look at the entire ecosystem together, including the economy, the environment, changes in the environment as a result of CO2 emissions, and the costs that are associated with either insults that come about as a result of those changes in the environment, or with attempts at mitigation of the environment. My sense of it is that the least expensive approach for us to take is the one that significantly reduces greenhouse gas emissions over time in all the different systems. I'm thinking about transportation, building codes and residential, commercial, industrial, and agriculture all together. Could you give us your sense of that? Is that a reasonable kind of analysis to make? And if so, where does that get us when you look at everything together? And I'm thinking everything, including the pollution that comes about as a result of diesel emissions in North Portland, and the effect on health of the people who live there, along with everything else. Doesn't it make the most sense for Oregon's economy that we proceed on this plan as to reduce greenhouse gas as quickly as reasonably possible in order to reduce the negative impacts and increase the positive ones?
Chairs Denbrough and Helm, Representative Barnhart, from where I sit, the first and most simple thing that I would look at is the externality or the cost that is imposed by carbon.
And that's the essence of my question. Mm-hmm. Thank you.
Right. Again, I'll speak for myself and not for the task force in saying that British Columbia has found the simplest. They've taken one approach, which was simply to price the carbon through a tax, and certainly that is in implementation and still debates up there. And I guess where the complications come in are obviously, number one, through winners and losers as you start that implementation. If first and foremost, you have industries and households and population that has organized themselves in Oregon without a carbon tax, and all of a sudden you change the price and you're disrupting that status quo. To Representative Brock Smith's point, we have Oklahoma out there. The last time I went to downtown Tulsa, I saw the Petroleum Club. I don't think they're going to have a carbon tax or a cap and trade system anytime soon. So you are in a context, and increasingly with a federal posture in the near term, where you're unlikely to have a lot of other actors in the United States making this move. And so it's a complicated space, and I think the term that you used at the very end of your question was, how far do you advance without complete disruption or derailing the economy, and it is, as the task force sort of discussed over the course of its year together. It's a complicated space where I think the task force members look at the science, they understand the science, they look at the current status quo of the industrial mix and household mix in Oregon and say, okay, we want to make a positive step forward that keeps the GDP growing, that keeps the population growing, and that builds some momentum on that GHG line. In the context of the rest of the United States, perhaps not following suit at the same time.
Chair Helmer, if I can just also respond to that. Speaking as a member of the task force, I think one of the ways the task force looked at this is not just from the environmental side of this, but being representatives of leading businesses, also the business opportunities that this presents. We're at a point in time. This is a case where a situation where you probably don't want to be the first in the nation to go out on this because it is so complicated. But we're not. We're still early in the game. We do have the examples in British Columbia. We have California. We have Ontario. Other comparable cases that we can look at where we can see what is working, what is not working, and that helps inform, I think, the modeling of this, not only to accomplish the environmental benefits, but also going back to the business case. To position ourselves to take advantage of being in the lead in moving that direction, recognizing that over time that is where the rest of the nation will be going. And the sooner we can get in with the right model, the better able we will be to position ourselves to take advantage of this as an opportunity.
Okay, so I've got Representatives Bence, Power, Helm, and then Holvey, and then we'll get to a second question from Brock Smith. These representatives, boy, they have a lot of questions. Rep. Bence, please.
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair. So in keeping with my lifelong ambition to try to get people to understand how water is actually diverted in this state, and this isn't my question, I just want to, when you bring the volume 2 or the second printing of this out, I want to correct it, because on page 20 it says, irrigation systems in Oregon move 85% of the state's water. That's not true. Irrigation systems move about 6% of the state's water. 92% stays in stream. Now, having made that point, for the record, I have a question, and I just want to go through that, which all the work you guys have done, which is just nothing short of amazing. But it all boils down to your strategy 4. Let me show you why. Yeah, the congestion piece we are going to solve in our transportation package. And the conversion to alternative fuel vehicles will be resolved by the low carbon fuel stamp abruptly and probably with great damage to the economy. The regain Oregon's leadership in energy efficiency, that we got an ETO, it's taking care of that at the cost of $150 million. Every 18 months. And the potential to benefit from agriculture, that I see as inadequately crafted, but perhaps there's something there. How to modernize what we invest. We heard about that some years ago when we saw a completely overblown analysis that the EQ brought us from an economist who I thank goodness I misplaced his name because it was so embarrassingly bad. And to go back, and I made copies of it just so I could hand them out 3 years ago to show how wrong he was. So that brings us to strategy four. I'm skipping over your seven and eight. Probably shouldn't. Strategy four is really interesting to me for the reason that Rep. Barnhart just raised. And what he was really saying was, have you guys done that global analysis, that portfolio look, to see if this is the correct place to be investing our time and our effort? Because, of course, everybody wants to reduce carbon output. That's kind of a no-brainer. The question is, though, how best do we invest our resources? Because they're limited in this little bitty state. I heard you reference science a couple of times. I would just say, and I ask, I think, the co-chairs to invite Roger Pelkey Jr. to talk to us. I guess he's an outlier when it comes to his suggestion that the proper focus isn't just on carbon reduction, it's on trying to figure out a solution that will actually help. I throw that out because Rep. Brock Smith appropriately says, wait, we're so small, we're so little. So we're going to be reducing carbon in many different ways. We've already started and doing a pretty good job of it because of laws already passed. So my question to the three of you is, do you have that clear analysis that says that a carbon tax is the proper and most efficient next thing for us to do? Is it the best thing, or if you're going to rank it in your strategies here, is it number four? The other two are better? Where does it fit, and tell me how you got there? And give us the recital of the analysis, the global analysis that's been done on what we're already doing. Please don't reference the Portland State study. I think it was totally inadequate. So, but having said that, way too long, but provide the answer.
Chairs Dembro and Helm, Representative Bentz, I would say that the task force did not have all the information to say that we should be doing a carbon tax or any kind of carbon pricing program. What the task force agreed to and said was we need some additional information to inform one, because at least from some of their perspectives, some kind of a pricing program is likely to be coming our way. And so we should definitely make sure that we're in the best position to inform that pricing program. In terms of how the task force prioritized the strategies, transportation, we saw some real opportunities to reduce emissions in transportation that would benefit the economy, and so that's why congestion pricing was identified as number one. In energy efficiency, that is typically the most cost-effective way to reduce greenhouse gas emissions is through finding efficiencies, and we see some opportunities for increasing efficiencies. So those were ones that ranked out very high, definitely, and came out on top.
Can you hear me or not?
Yes.
Sorry to jump on, no, Kathy, no, and I'll limit my comments because I'm getting a ton of feedback when I talk, which is distracting, but I would just add on to what you said, that there is a fair amount of unanimity among economists that carbon pricing or cap and trade is by far the most impactful single measure you can take for GHG reduction. And we've got, short of a federal approach, which clearly is not going to be happening under this administration, and I'm personally not a believer in a single state approach, but we've got a real regional opportunity together with California, which has its cap and trade measures, British Columbia, which has got a carbon tax, and Washington, which will likely be coming on board sometime soon with its own either cap and trade or carbon tax platform. So there is very much an opportunity for a strong regional approach there.
And so in terms of the research, and Merritt made reference to it, I think there's reference in the report to the IGM, University of Chicago poll of 40 smartest economists in the United States, and as close to a consensus as you're going to get on a topic, that if you believe the science and greenhouse gas reduction is your goal, the most cost-effective, efficient way to get there is through some pricing mechanism, and so that create, again, it's within a context of you know, winners and losers who are on the ground today, other states that aren't doing it, a federal posture that is less receptive than it was 8 months ago, so there's
there remains an awful lot of complexity with that answer. But a host of regulations that regulatory measures and fuel standards and et cetera that are in place in law now that you would need to go back and reevaluate if you ever did get to a sizable carbon price. Because then, in essence, what you're doing is you're wearing your suspenders and your belt at the same time. And you've got to decide, do you want to wear your suspenders or you're going to use your belt to keep your pants up?
And if my colleagues will indulge me, I'm going to channel Representative Bentz for a moment as if he hasn't done a good enough job by himself. But one of the questions that he has raised in past meetings that we've had in this joint committee is who do we trust, right, in terms of the people that we're going to be looking to for advice on our next steps? Who do we look to that's not doesn't have a personal interest that may be, you know, motivating them in a certain direction, who can really address the particular issues that Oregon is facing, you know, the situation here in Oregon. I'm sure, John, you would say Eco Northwest and
that DEQ study he referenced before. Clearly, if they had called us, it wouldn't have turned out as badly, right?
But I think
exactly right.
Yeah, I think we would it would benefit us at some point to get some advice along those lines as we're looking to the next steps here. Where do we turn to for expertise? And we have a lot of brain power here on this panel, but we're going to need real expertise, I think.
Yeah, I would say that the group that Merritt's father has assembled at the national level, that is a pretty remarkable group and headed by, you know, unusual suspects, Republicans looking at climate change policy, and they brought substantial resources to bear to investigate and look at evidence-based solutions to this. So certainly, you know, the consultants and the experts and the white papers being generated out of that space would be a place that I would turn to and feel like I'm finding some objective advice.
Mm-hmm. Okay, thanks. Rep Power.
Oh, thank you. So I'm hearing comments from some of my colleagues, and I've heard from others too, about investing a lot of time and resources in averting an outcome that I think some people think is going to happen anyway. I'm both young enough and I think optimistic enough that with the right suite of tools and approaches, Oregon can develop a next generation of environmental policies to help combat some of these things. I think it's going to be done in partnership with businesses, and I appreciate you bringing us this body of work to really chew on. I was looking through some of your conclusions and trying to decipher what those can mean for us here. And the one I've been sort of muddling on is rewarding performance, not investment. A lot of the things that we have at our disposal are getting to investments, you know, through tax credits or tax abatements, economic zones, and others. What does rewarding performance, not investment, look like for you and the panel of folks who looked at this?
I think that refers to, and I can send you a paper that goes into this in more detail, but I think the reference there, and excuse me, Chairs Dembrough and Helm, Representative Power, I think the reference is that there are certain policies that you can tie to how much a company invests in reduce, you know, to do something. And there are other ways to structure it that actually look at performance, the performance that comes back. And so when you can, with certain kinds of policies, you want to focus it as much as you can on performance. There are times when that's challenging to do, and we talked about that when we talked about Oregon's business code, building codes. There are codes that are determined based on actual performance of reducing emissions from buildings. But that's a very expensive thing to monitor and track and report and determine. And so, you know, maybe that's not one you can do easily through a performance base, and you have to look at it through an investment base. But anytime you're developing strategies, you should go through that thought process. And if there's an easy path to really paying for actual reduction, then that's the direction you should go rather than relative to investment. Does that make sense?
Chair Dembrow, Chair Helm, Representative Power. One other thing you touched on, I've heard in the conversation so far too, is the size of Oregon relative to the size of the problem, and how are we going to really achieve an outcome based on, you know, the in terms of size. And that's one of the things, of course, we talked about at the task force. One of the interests that we have in terms of modeling this carbon pricing is also to look at a regional-based program, so that it's not just within the four boundaries of Oregon, but also can we participate in programs that are already being implemented regionally, and by that enhance our impact and get the benefit of their impacts as well.
Great. Mr. Chair, so this is for the business people, and Mr. Paulson, I'd love for you to be able to chime in here. In discussing the impacts of being part of the Western Climate Initiative with Quebec and Ontario and California, we have heard over and over about the market advantage of being in that system. And, you know, I want to know why. You know, I want to dig down a little bit more. Why is it a market advantage for us to move quickly as a state to do this?
Key question.
And John, I'm happy to have you respond as well.
Merrick, you want to take?
Are you looking for me to speak first?
Yeah, please
do.
Fire him. Yeah.
And I'll defer to John and your expertise here. But again, my understanding is Oregon's got a particular advantage given our abundance of hydropower from a credit standpoint relative to some of these other states. I don't think we're recommending that we jump in with 2 feet first right away. I mean, that we explicitly say otherwise. We want to really be careful in how we design the program, make sure we give the right credits towards industries who would be adversely affected and low income families as well. But the hydropower point is a point that I've heard made several times, and again, John, I'm happy to punt to you.
Well, I would say, you know, to what extent do you believe that this is where we're headed in 5, 10, 20 years? And the more that you buy into the science, essentially, I think what the task force believes is the country is headed in this direction. It may be pulled by pain before it's pushed by vision, but we're headed there. And so to the extent that we can stay toward the front, maybe not in the front, but toward the front of this move, we're going to be better positioned all along the way. And I think, you know, getting back to that chart that Representative Brock Smith drew our attention to at the very beginning is... It is the chart to pay attention to. How do you keep that GDP, population, and job growth positive while accelerating that bottom line in the smartest way you possibly can?
And I think just to build on that, you know, the Oregon's low-cost energy has been a great selling point. It's brought businesses here. And if there's a way that we can both keep the energy costs low and reduce carbon, which is going to be more and more a factor for businesses as policies advance, then that's another selling point for businesses to come to Oregon.
Sure.
And this, again, talking about first mover advantage or near first mover advantage, I remember Kathy mentioned that about 37% of our sequestration capability in the state is in our ag and our forest sectors. Is there a first mover advantage represented by those sectors? And How much has that been developed so far?
Chair Helm, Chair Dembrough, members of the committee, that's a very good question. I think that the land-based opportunities are relatively new in terms of how people understand what can be accomplished and how to best take advantage of that. One of the things that we discussed in the task force is that we'd want to be mindful about the economics of making decisions in that space as well as in all the other spaces, and we'd want to make sure we were doing that in a way that, didn't impact Oregon's forest products industry and agriculture. But there are some good opportunities for sequestration in soils that provide better water holding capacity through inclusion of biochar, for example, in agriculture. And as we get smarter at doing those kinds of things, then I think there are advantages for Oregon, and we can start exporting innovation in those those sectors just like we are in others.
Rep. Hovey.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm looking at your presentation, and really thank you for putting all this together. There's a lot of pieces to it, and probably a lot more detail to each piece than I've really had time to look at. But if I were looking at this, I notice, you know, there's a whole piece in here about creation of jobs and job creation. And if we were to assume that our goal was to reduce greenhouse gas emissions, and that looking at your presentation appears that there's job opportunities there as well, do you see the price on carbon as being one of the drivers to help us invest in some of these new programs like renewable energy, solar, wind? We didn't have a lot of those, you know, previously. Wave could be something of the future. All those things look like they create jobs as well, while at the same time trying to reduce greenhouse gas emissions. So do you see the price on carbon as essentially being one of the drivers to enable us to make those sorts of investments?
Yeah. Sure. Chairs Dembrough, Helm, Representative Hovey, absolutely. I mean, that is the sort of the economic textbook argument is get the price right and get out of the way and let the market react to that price. So if the price on carbon were to change, then every actor, households, drivers, office tenants, office owners, et cetera, would all have different incentives in front of them. And frankly, some of what we're doing through regulation would become less necessary because the price would be sitting there.
And if you were using a cap and invest type approach, you could take some of those proceeds and specifically invest in energy efficiency and other strategies that would create jobs here in Oregon.
Follow up. And I appreciate that as we're looking at, you know, because I go to another one of your slides about modernizing how Oregon invests in greenhouse gas emissions reduction. And one of those persons, or one of those, I guess, goals would be to, you know, invest in ways to mitigate the impacts from climate change, adaptation. You know, we want to put some money into shellfish. We want to put money into other impacts that are happening, you know, more forest fires, those sorts of things that are actually costing us real dollars that this looks like it would enable us to make better investments there. But I'm really, I don't know who wrote this one little bullet, but I'd really like to learn more about your recommendation on the small-scale energy loan program to use credit enhancements. There's a proposal that the House committee anyway passed that is moving that loan program to Business Oregon, where it would have better financial risk analysis. For example, Department of Energy was not well suited to do that type of work. And it seems like outside of a couple of loans, three large loans that really didn't have good risk analysis done to it, the rest of the loans performed very well in that portfolio. But at the same time, I think the Debt Capacity Commission recommended not going forward with making any more loans out of that program, largely because the marketplace isn't right for the government making those types of loans anymore, though that could change. But I'm really curious how you are making those recommendations to use that program to use credit enhancements and other financial tools, I quote, to better leverage private investments and transform it into a fully functioning green bank. Could you explain that to me a little bit?
Chair Denborough, Chair
Or if not, you can try
Representative Holby.
You want to send me a white paper? That's
absolutely. What I was going to say is there are some folks that we were able to talk with in Connecticut and some other places that have done these kinds of things. And so we'd be happy to connect you with those folks to help you think about some of the other tools that the SELP program maybe could use to leverage private capital. We'd be happy to do that.
Rip Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. John, I want to get back to your comment about belts and suspenders. I think if we start taking an inventory, I think we might see that we have enough to begin to open up our own store around here. But just beginning from the report's data in here, about a 21% decrease in per capita emissions over whatever period of time. Couple with that our BPA feed that comes in and supplies all of our PUDs and co-ops and so forth is already 95% carbon free, mostly hydro, some new, you know, that. On top of that, now we've got the low carbon fuel standard that was passed and it's being implemented, and that is intended to have a reduction of carbon intensity of fuel. We passed the coal to clean bill last session, which will also de-coal our electric feed coming in from our IOUs. You mentioned the need for a transportation package in here that actually has cost pricing built into it for congestion mitigation. That's, I think, underway. Representative Bentz promises us that's soon to be unveiled. So I guess my point is there's many things going on in the state already, and I guess from an economist standpoint, and again somebody who I think has done a lot of great work on the Oregon business plan, which we appreciate, factoring in, we also had a report from PSU, Tom Petoskey, the work he did sometime in the past, where in their model they didn't model it beyond $150 a ton because he didn't feel you could change behavior. The economy couldn't handle it, first of all, and at that price you really can't change behaviors, unfortunately. So I guess my question is, we get into talking about pricing, how high would you as an economist think we could responsibly go without, again, getting into the danger territory with our Oregon business plan, but also something that isn't at such a low level that all we're doing is repatriating money from one sector of the economy to another, but in the process we have to create a really complicated bureaucracy to make it all happen. So as you weigh all these things as an economist giving input to folks like us at the policy level, how are we going to figure out a pricing level that actually will change behaviors, which is what you have to do, really. You have to convince somebody to get out of that clunker and do something different, or turn down their thermostat, or do something different than they currently are. You've been asked by Senator Denbrough to provide input, so I'm just curious how you would factor all those suspenders and belts to make sure they don't end up around our neck.
Very good. Representative Johnson. Thank you for the question. Again, this is a sort of taking a step past and getting into more detail than the task force got into, so I'll speak from my own perspective, not from the task force on this particular piece. I would say, the folks who our company follows and watches, et cetera, are headed in similar directions, be it draft proposals, design proposals out of the Brookings Institution, what you've seen in British Columbia, what was attempted by a former Echo Northwest employee in Washington State with their measure from last year, Yorman Bauman, University of Washington professor, who took what was probably the most pure economic textbook approach that you possibly could take. Literally, it was right out of an appendix of a textbook, and met the same political fate as Measure 97. It was 41-59. So, you know, the general approach, the simplest approach that a policy wonk economist would give is find what you believe to be, you agree that the social price of carbon is, what is the value of the externality? $20, $30, $40 a ton, somewhere in that neighborhood we could debate. You know, the challenge there is you have modeling and you have a distribution of costs, and then this average comes up with simulations that, you know, some of the costs are relatively low, but then you have these tail outcomes that are catastrophes. You know, 75 years from now, the Greenland slips into the North Atlantic and changes the climate, and Europe goes into an ice age. I mean, so that's some of what this some of this work entails, and how do you price that? But in any event, you know, you're in the tens of dollars per ton starting with, and then you grow it over time. And that's what was proposed in the Washington proposal. At the same time, essentially what they were saying is we're going to enact this tax, but we're going to dial back the gross receipts tax a little bit and the sales tax. So again, you know, looking into the economic textbook, it was under the principle of tax things you don't want and tax less things that you do want. And they, to the best of their ability, tried to be revenue neutral as they came out there. So Yorman Bauman's answer is sort of that's the Brookings Institution. It's pretty close to what British Columbia has tried, but it does, to your very fair point, land in a context of an awful lot of rules and regulations that have been passed and that are sitting on the ground today. And so, you know, if Oregon were to go down the road of pricing, it would need to sort of step back and say, what is in place with respect to all these various things that are attempting to achieve a common goal, and how many of those should be relaxed if we're going to switch our strategy, in essence.
I think the other consideration is that a tax gives you more certainty of cost. A cap and trade program gives you more certainty of outcome, and in terms of greenhouse gas emission reduction, if you set mandatory caps and direct agencies to invest in programs to meet that. And so I think the cap, you know, we're spending a lot more time talking about one of the recommendations than others, or one of the topics than others. But in terms of thinking about a tax versus some kind of a cap and trade or cap and invest program, you can get more certainty in reduction. And you can also put some price caps on it so that you ensure that it isn't just about the price pushing that that direction on reduction of greenhouse gas emissions. So I think there are opportunities to design the program that don't mean that you have to just figure out exactly how much it's going to cost to change people's behavior.
Okay, Rick Brocksmith.
Thank you.
Thank you for your patience.
Oh, no. Appreciate the discussion and all the conversation from everyone. I would like to go back to a couple comments that were made by the gentleman on my left and some of the members here. And really goes back to some where Representative Helm, Co-Chair Helm, was talking about as far as the question to you, ma'am, and the wood products industry and the conversation about the committee on that. And it was your answer, unfortunately, was disappointing to me, because it wasn't part of a robust conversation with regards to the task force. And if you look at my district, which is Southwest Oregon, what we do is grow trees, and there isn't a better carbon sequester than trees. And so I would think that this would be in the forefront of the carbon of the conversation when we talk about not only greenhouse emissions but also sequestration. When we talk about jobs in the carbon credit sector, we should also be talking about the jobs that have been lost because of the lack of carbon sequestering through the trees. When we talk about what I'd like to have is an overall, if we're going to talk about Oregon in the global climate emission discussion, then we need to talk about the hypocritical practices that have occurred. And that is when you have 500,000 acres of land burn up in the Biscuit Fire, there's more carbon emissions that come from that smoke than California produces in a year, relatively. And there's data to support that. And then there's only 2% that's salvaged. And so not only is all that carbon that was stored, was it burned up into the atmosphere, causing problems with and just exacerbating, you know, global climate change, right? Then it's left to rot on the forest floor, thus only producing more greenhouse gas emissions, right? And yet there's no conversation about that. And that needs to be a conversation. And when we talk about, sir, you spoke about the right model in some of your talks. Well, that's how you get to the right model. You manage the timber resources that we have so that we aren't producing carbon emissions through catastrophic wildfire while we're also sequestering those carbon emissions through the harvesting of the timber and therefore making a more sustainable and resilient forest. Because we're long past the point of just putting a fence around those resources and letting it go back to nature.
But so I suspect there are several questions in there.
I'm sorry. So the question is, as we move forward, when are we going to bring these conversations to the forefront? Because what I see is a conversation where carbon credits come from the pockets of the citizens of Oregon. And in my district, we have, encompasses all of timber resources. They don't have the dollars to give you because they can't harvest the sequestered carbon that is there. So when is that going to be part of the task force and be on the forefront of?
Sure.
Yeah.
Chairs Dembrough and Helm, Representative Brock Smith. We did talk about forest and ag, and that's exactly why we wanted to talk about that subject, even though, you know, relatively speaking to transportation and residential and commercial, it currently looks like a smaller part of the problem and solution. The first two recommendations under ag and forestry are to get a better sense of land-based carbon accounting and how that works, and to look at how we can better utilize forest biomass to as possible energy sources. So that was definitely something that we spent time talking about in the task force and think is a really important part of how Oregon moves forward. Speaking on behalf of the Nature Conservancy, we are very involved and supportive of reducing catastrophic fire, uncharacteristically severe fires like the Biscuit Fire, by looking at how we can reduce fuel loads and thin the trees back out. And so we appreciate that there are some really important strategies for improving the health of Oregon's forests, providing fiber to our mills. And also one of the things that we've been talking about a little bit in developing, if there was to be a carbon pricing program in Oregon, if we connected with California, we could potentially come up with some new protocols that would allow mass timber to be one of the strategies you could use to to invest, you know, as a mitigation approach. So there are some potential opportunities in the forest and ag sector for, you know, better understanding how we could be managing our forests in a way that would sequester more and also provide products that, that would also sequester more.
And colleagues, we're going to be having a meeting sometime in June, I think, where we're going to be pursuing this question of, you know, timber in our forests and, you know, more along the lines of the questions that Rep. Brock-Smith was asking. Senator Linthicum, and then I think we're going to have to start wrapping up, colleagues.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. In terms of how this works and your modeling concept, can you tell me how you circle back and look at, review, or examine, critically examine prior data accumulations and mold that or meld that into your current model? If you go back to the very first figure in Governor Kulongoski's advisory committee in the 2004 Oregon Strategy for Greenhouse Gas Reduction report, you will see figure one that has a projection through the year 2000. We knew what our emissions levels were, and the suggestion in this very first graph is that by the year 2025, we'll be at 165% of normal, and that's in quotes, if we sit by and don't do anything. And we have heard up and down the line that all sorts of things have been done. But that 160% today in 2017, we would actually be at 145% had we done nothing. In fact, today we're closer to 82%. We're below the 1990 level and performing very nicely, especially according to your graphic that we see, which is on your page, must be your page 10, which is the chart that shows real GDP, less computer, population growth, non-farm, and then GHG emissions falling steadily. Isn't it true that the model should be reworked given the new system and data, and therefore we're making projections about, quote, sitting around when nobody, in fact, is sitting around? There is no stasis. Can you tell me how you're planning about thinking that? The reason I'm asking is I'm very tenuous of the idea of carbon taxing is the most efficient way to accomplish your goals. Indeed, the power to tax is the power to destroy, but I know that's not our goal, is it?
Certainly not.
Thank you.
I'm sure I'm speaking for
yes. Senator.
Thank you,
Representative Helm, Senator Linthicum. Certainly not. You know, this is an area where I mean, you have a former legislator, an environmental researcher, and a policy wonk, economic consultant sitting here. You would want regular input from real scientists, climate scientists, et cetera. And yeah, this is a topic that I think requires constant renewal and watch. And to Senator Denbrough's point, you know, where can you find that objective group that is giving you scientific forecasts that as broad of a span of you would agree that you want to hook into. But this is a topic even more so than revenue forecasts that, you know, if you go back 15 years or 20 years, et cetera, you're going to see both trends and innovation in terms of what we're accomplishing, but then changing understanding of the potential costs and risks that are associated with the trend as well. So something that does take you know, an annual look, or at a minimum every 3 years a hard look at where you are on this path and how to adjust to it.
Okay, well, just in wrapping up, I want to thank you all obviously for coming here. Not you, Merritt, but thank you. Sorry. you look as if you're probably in a better place than this room. But thank you for your patience in staying here. And I do have to say also, on behalf of my grandson, who has the misfortune of living in Seattle, thank you for building such a great team in the Timbers. He's a huge fanatic. Thank you all for all the work that you've put into this report. And what I hear is a commitment to keep working on this issue with us. You know, Representative Helm and I, a couple of weeks ago, met with some people from Quebec, and they were giving us some advice in terms of moving forward. And, you know, one of the things that they said was really an important element in their developing their carbon pricing program was just spending a lot of time with people from industry, from business and industry, just seeing what were going to be the particular challenges within that sector and coming up with a solution to it. And they felt that they largely were able to do that by people coming to the table and having, you know, frank problem-solving kinds of conversations. I think clearly that's something we're going to need to do. We have a lot of work ahead of us, but, you know, I think we're committed to working on this. So thank you again for being here, everyone. Thanks for your attention.
Thank you. Thank you.
And see you next time.
Thank you very much for the opportunity.
Okay, we are adjourned.
Thank you.